I was in a coma for 6 weeks while the doctors told my wife I was going to die. When I woke up, she told me the most fantastic story. My team kept running the business without me. Freelancers reached out to my team and said, "We will do whatever it takes as long as Craig's in the hospital." I consider that the greatest accomplishment in my career. My name is Craig Andrews, and this is the Leaders and Legacies podcast, where we talk to leaders creating an impact beyond themselves. At the end of today's interview, I'll tell you how you can be the next leader featured on this show. Today, I want to welcome Christian Espinosa. I've been talking to Christian off camera. We're gonna cover a number of things today that I think you really want to hear. It's going to be a little bit about personal choices and health. It's going to be a little bit about interacting with others and seizing the moment. And we're going to talk, a little bit about running businesses, running and selling businesses. Christian has authored a couple books. One is called The Smartest Person in the Room. And points out, if I understand correctly, that you don't necessarily want to be the smartest person in the room. I mean, maybe you end up there, but there's something missed. And more recently, he's published The In-Between, Life in the Micro. And that we're going to spend a lot of time talking about that. I'm really excited by that. Christian has built and successfully sold Alpine Security, a cybersecurity business, and he currently leads Blue Goat Cyber. And so with that, Christian, welcome.
Thank you, Craig. Thanks for the nice introduction. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah. So, you know, we were talking, and one of the things that it turns out that you and I have in common is both of us, about 2 years ago, had a near early departure from this world. What happened with you?
I had just flown back from Phoenix to St. Louis. I live in Phoenix now, ironically. And I worked out. I was doing some burpees for about 30 minutes. And then I noticed my left leg started hurting pretty badly right behind my knee. And I was talking to a friend of mine on the phone, and she told me that I might have blood clots. And I'm like, whatever. I'm an Ironman athlete. I don't get blood clots. I was just worked out, you know. Things like that don't happen to people like me. But she told me to go to the hospital and made me promise. So I went to the hospital and I was diagnosed with 6 blood clots in my lower left leg. And if I would have waited much longer, I could have had a stroke or a pulmonary embolism and, you know, made it through. So that drastically changed my life.
Yeah. Let me translate that for those without their medical dictionary handy. Pulmonary embolism. That basically means you get a blood clot. If I'm interpreting the words correctly, you get a blood clot in your lungs, and your body quits getting oxygen. Is that?
That's right. That's correct.
I'm guessing that's probably pretty bad.
That, or, you know, a blood clot travels to your brain and you have a stroke. Those were the two primary risk that the blood clots had. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just one, I had 6. So like most of my veins and my lower left leg were constricted with these clots, and that was what was causing the pain.
Oh my goodness. Thank goodness you're here, and thank goodness for your friend. What was her background? Was she a nurse, a EMT, a doctor?
She just was very into tune to everything. I would say she's more holistic medicine, but she's well versed in medicine. And she asked me a couple questions, like if I was having a hard time breathing going up the stairs, and I was, and I'm like, that's kind of weird. Like, I'm usually in great shape. I thought I just pulled a muscle. I didn't know it was a blood clot. But after a series of questions she asked me, which I guess in her mind indicated I probably had blood clots, is why she wanted me to go to the hospital.
Wow. And so you get to the hospital, they do an ultrasound. How long did it take them to figure out that you had clots?
So I went to the hospital, and I don't like going to hospitals. I tried to go to one of those 24-hour emergency care places first. They told me they couldn't help, that I had to go to the emergency room in the hospital. I went there. They took my blood pressure. My blood pressure was super high. It was like 180 over something. It's usually like 110 over like 80. So that was kind of an indication that something might be wrong. And then I waited for about 30 or 40 minutes, and they took me back and gave me the ultrasound with a wand on my leg. And then they had to wait a little bit longer, and finally a doctor came out and just told me he said, "You have blood clots." And he said, "You had six of them in your left leg." And I was kind of freaked out. I don't really know anything about blood clots. So I asked him, I was like, "Well, what does this mean?" And he said, "Well, it means you could have a stroke or die any moment." So I started kind of freaking out a little bit because I was there by myself. I didn't have any family nearby. And he saw me freaking out because I was like starting to cry silently, thinking like my life is over. And he said, he told me, he's like, "Don't worry, I see this all the time." And it like kind of like upset me because I'm like, I don't see this all the time. This is a first for me. And that lack of empathy, I think it was an attempted empathy, really struck me. And that is things along those lines are what I wrote about in my last book, actually. So a lot of that journey with the blood clots influenced my last book.
I in my journey through the hospital, the now I was in the hospital at the peak of COVID, and doctors were really stressed out, but the there was a huge human element missing. And it sounds like you had the same thing.
100%. Yeah, I think I wrote about this in my first book also. I guess it's a common theme in my life. When we see ourselves as a role or a certain position, and we see ourselves separate from other people, like patient and doctor versus we're both humans, I think it's hard to have that empathy because you don't see the other person as a human. You see them as, whatever role they're depicted in based on your role. And I think we have a big problem with that in our society with, pro-vaccine, anti-vaccine, Democrats, Republicans, all these different factions create division. And it's hard to have empathy when you see people different from yourself. And I think that's a big problem in our society.
One of the, I think there were a number of sad moments in my journey, but one of the sad ones I missed, I was still in a coma. I was about to leave the ICU. I was about to be their first survivor that went on a ventilator. And my wife, the doctor who had been overseeing me for the prior month, comes by the room, and my wife says, "Hey, it's like the day before I'm leaving." And she's like, "Isn't this awesome? Isn't this great that he's going to make it?" And the doctor just kind of quipped back smugly, or not very kind. And he just said, "Well, he's very weak." And
Wow.
it was shocking. It still shocks me to this day. Of, They should have been propping my hand up on the gurney as they were rolling me out of the hospital, doing high fives as their first survivor. And but instead, they were it was missing that human element that we're talking about. Interesting. So obviously you got better. They put you on blood thinners and what have you. What did you find out what the root cause was? Is there a root cause? How did it resolve itself?
Well, it was a very frustrating journey. No, they did my blood work. There was no root cause in the blood work. I did get the Johnson and Johnson COVID vaccine, but no one will say that that was a cause either. They gave me blood thinners. So I took blood thinners for almost a year, and during that time, I had left my parent company that I sold my previous cybersecurity company to, So I had to get my own insurance, and I couldn't get insurance because I had a pre-existing condition now. So I was paying like $600 a month for these blood thinners. And I really didn't want to take them, but my girlfriend's a nurse and she's like, you can't just stop taking the blood thinners. So I kind of weaned myself off of them, which is probably not the best thing to do. But I just remember one day looking at that pill of blood thinners and I'm like, and my life was pretty sedentary. I was afraid to do anything because another clot might break off. People were telling me not to go work out, not to run, you might die. And I was, you know, so I was looking at the blood thinners and I just like threw them across the room and said, screw this, I'm not taking these anymore. I'm gonna go get my blood tested, every single blood test possible, and reclaim my health. And that's what I did. I started doing like IV therapy with NAD plus and different things to help. I got a pulmonary specialist to look at my leg thoroughly with a Doppler ultrasound to make sure there were no clots. And I still get my blood measured routinely, but I don't take blood thinners anymore. And I've started running again. I did a half Ironman triathlon. Before that, I was doing a lot more. So it's been a journey, but I feel good that I took charge of my health and reclaimed my own life and not listen to everybody that told me not to do anything, but sit on the couch all day and just be grateful that I'm alive. You know, that I went from, it was a pretty dark place for me. I went from being super active and super confident to kind of just sitting in the dark in my basement for a while, wondering what my life is going to turn out to be.
Yeah. And I think that's such an important point. I can tell you, similar to you, the big advancements I've made in my own recovery and in my own health have been my initiatives, not the initiatives that the doctors have put me on.
Mm-hmm.
And including getting off medicine, you know, and they had me on a blood thinner, maybe the same, I don't want to say the brand on air, but the, I think it was probably the same brand if it began with an E. And, what was funny was I asked the doctor, I was like, hey, how do I get off? I just want to get off all drugs. And
yeah.
And she said, well, to get off the blood thinner, you need to have a ultrasound. And what was wild was I went and had the ultrasound done. And as soon as the nurse or technician started wanding me, doing my legs, I heard this sound, you know, this mm-hmm. sound.
Yeah.
You remember it?
Yes.
And what was wild was I know that sound. And I texted my wife. And I said, hey, when I was in the hospital, did I have an ultrasound? She's like, yeah, it took forever. I said, yeah, you got frustrated and left. And she's like, well, it was past visitation. I had to leave. And I started asking her some questions. So this was something that showed up in the dreams in my coma. And for me, I knew I was getting a test, but the sounds that the ultrasound were making, I thought that was some form of weird e-commerce that when they were done, we were trying to pay them and it would do this weird form of e-commerce that made all these weird noises.
Wow.
And but as soon as I heard it outside my coma, I'm like, I know that sound. I remember it from when I was checked out. But yeah, so that's my journey with blood thinners and what have you. What Ironmans had you run?
I had done 24 before I had the blood clots. I think all of them in North America, including Hawaii, the World Championship. I've done that one as well.
Wow. You've probably been in my hometown. Did you ever do the Ironman in Cambridge, Maryland?
Yes. That's the one with the crawdads, I think crawdads, I think is on the logo, and they have the jellyfish. When I did it, a lot of us got stung by jellyfish. I did it the year after it rained a whole bunch and people were running through like a foot of water, it seemed like, on the course. Yeah.
Yeah.
I did do that one.
Yeah. So I was there back in September My brother lives like right across the street from Great Marsh where the Iron Man begins. And so, yeah, the we back there, we call them sea nettles, but yeah, jellyfish. And yes, that's so wild. Well, very cool. But so that's really interesting. And so if in terms of if you were to give one message to anybody that has some type of health issue, a simple, clear message of how you would advise them, what would that be?
That nobody cares about your health or your life as much as you do. So do everything you can do to take charge of your own health and do your own research and get second opinions. And don't just take what a doctor tells you for granted.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'll second that. And I'll go a step further. If some doctor is looking frustrated or ridicules you for asking questions, get a new doctor.
100%.
They are legally and ethically bound to answer your questions. They may not like it, but the ones that are good and the ones that are, you know, that's their job. That's their job. You got to own your health. So good word. So you said that some of the things that you learned in the process kind of led to your book, The In-Between, Life in the Micro. And kind of high level, what's that book about and how did that come out of your experience with blood clots?
That book is about high achievers. I consider myself a high achiever. Sometimes we get super focused on a macro goal or a big goal. And often we get so hyper-focused on that, we miss things like right in front of us between where we are and that goal. And I call those the micro moments. Mm-hmm. And some of those moments, if we pay attention and we show up with intention, we can add value to a moment with somebody else. And also, those moments might inform us that this thing we're going after so fervently may not actually be the thing we want anymore. And maybe we should shift direction a little bit and go after something more in alignment with who we are. So the book is largely about that. It's more of a focused memoir on, you know, where I've screwed things up horribly because I've been too focused on the big thing and I missed something right in front of me and like destroyed a relationship. Or like fell down a mountain and almost died, you know, cause I zoned out for a second and I wasn't in the moment. And it's about where I got some of it right too. You know, it's just a focused memoir around that topic. And I ended up finishing the book, like maybe 6 months after the blood clots. I had written a lot of it before then, but the clots, I think, were a culmination of a lot of things going on with me emotionally, the result of my hyper macro focus. And I felt trapped in a number of ways. And I think from a manifestation point of view, that feeling trapped may have manifested in, you know, the 6 clots I had in my left leg. So I felt trapped in a number of areas of my life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in terms of in the moment, you know, one of the things that you mentioned in the green room was you said people go around in sort of a zombie-like state.
Mm-hmm.
And what's that look like and what's that mean to you?
Well, I myself have gone through life in a zombie-like state. It's where you're kind of only focused on yourself and your problems, and you don't have the awareness to be in touch with what else is going on around you. Today, it's even more exacerbated with cell phones. Like I'm looking out the window now and I always see people walking their dogs, but they're always on their phone, like looking down and you know, we're developing this epidemic of text neck. You know, people look down all the time and their necks are starting to get screwed up. So I think that's part of it, where just like yesterday, I was walking back to my place and I saw this person. I've seen him a couple times and I said, "Hey, how's it going?" And this person looked at me and then looked away. And it was just like, it kind of like bothered me that a fellow human being couldn't even say hello because it's obvious he saw me. So it's about like those moments. That was a moment where we could have had a small interaction that lifted each other up versus him just like acting like I wasn't even there, for instance. And I think we often forget these super small moments to us, especially when we're interacting with somebody, just a simple smile, a hello, you could make somebody's day. But we often are so immersed in our own world that we forget about that.
Yeah. You know, when you smile at somebody, it causes the uncontrolled release of dopamine in them.
Yeah.
And it's a gift. We have the power to give many times a day. I mean, think about that. We have the ability to give somebody a gift of a little shot of happiness in their day. And it's what you're talking about. It's just stopping long enough to look them in the eye and smile.
Yeah. Doesn't cost us anything.
Yes.
It actually makes us feel better too. If you smile, it's proven that you're going to feel better yourself. So why not? You know, it's just a simple thing to do.
Yeah. You know, I spent about 15 years in the mobile phone industry. You know, that was the beginning. That was sort of the first half of my career.
Mm-hmm.
And they've changed our world, but some of the things you're talking about, I agree. I think they've changed our world in a way that's not good. And yeah. So for, you know, if we just assume that most people have kind of crossed the line and have an unhealthy relationship with their phone, what's some practical advice that you would give to these people?
I think some of the practical advice is to consider the person you're with, and that they probably, like most of us, want to feel seen and heard. And if you're on your phone, that person is not feeling seen and heard, and you're diminishing that relationship, and that relationship is going to suffer ultimately. And I think if you think of it from the converse, at least I do, and somebody is, if I'm out to dinner with my girlfriend or someone and they're on their phone the whole time, I just want to leave. I'm like, what? Why are we even here out to dinner? This person's too busy in a different world and we're sitting right across from each other. So I think we underestimate the impact that has on people we're with. And we've sort of just tolerated it. And I'm a believer that we get what we tolerate. And I don't, like, if somebody is on the phone with me and we're having a conversation, I just stop talking and I disengage. I'm not going to tolerate that. And I think if more of us did that, we would have a better, more empathetic society, because we would actually have meaningful conversations where we're present with the other person.
Yeah. Yeah. Boy, I tell you what, you're hitting a lot of, you're hitting a lot of points for me. And that's, you know, I do the same thing. If I'm talking to somebody and their phone buzzes and they pull it out, in that moment, I stop talking. And if they keep engaging in their phone, I just kind of walk away. I figure that was the end of the conversation.
Yes.
And it's sad. And, you know, I read a study yesterday, I believe, and it's there's the number of mental health issues in young people went up significantly starting in around 2010. You know, so the iPhone came out in late 2007, and took a couple of years for it. You know, the first generation iPhone was a data phone that kind of sucked at data. And so, you know, so the first real quality data phone showed up, you know, late 2009. And so starting around 2009. And so as it started taking up, it's interesting that with the advent of these smartphones, mental health started declining.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. Yeah, people today, they don't interact as much as they used to. And I think as humans, we're a social species, and doing it on the phone with someone across the world is not the same as, you know, face-to-face or direct interaction.
Yeah. So, well, that's really cool. I hope people, I like that message. I think it's an important message, the in-between life and the micro. I hope people will buy that book, read it, and have some more impactful relationships in their day-to-day. I'm curious about one last thing. Curious about a lot, but for our time today, I'm kind of interested in, you obviously are, you know, you've built and sold a business, you've built another, and your first book was The Smartest Person in the Room, which you say explores limitations of seeking validation through achievement and the desire to be the brightest intellect in any room. Well, so you're obviously accomplished. You've done a bunch of Ironmans. It sounds like you excel at whatever you do. First off, let's just start with some background. What was Alpine Security? You know, how did you found that and grow that?
That was my first cybersecurity business. I was an employee of a company. I was making decent money. I was a vice president, and I got into kind of this ongoing argument with the CEO. And one day I just decided to quit because it was like mentally taxing on me. And I just quit with no job lined up. And that was a blessing in disguise. So after that, I did freelance work for about 5 years. And then I got bored with the freelance work and started Alpine Security. The freelance work, you know, I was working about half the year, making a lot of money, but I felt like I wasn't growing and I wasn't contributing to society in the way I wanted to. So that was the impetus to start my first cybersecurity business. I felt like if I could get a business going, hire people, build a team, I'll learn a lot. I can serve our clients better. And I'm contributing to society in a way. And I'm also helping shape other people, at least influence them while they're also influencing me. And that was the impetus of my first company. And then I sold that in December of 2020 to a publicly traded company.
And what type of businesses did Alpine Security focus on?
We primarily focused in healthcare. And we did penetration testing, which is ethical hacking. We're like the good guys that are hired to break into your environment using the same tactics, techniques, and procedures that the black hats or the cyber criminals use. And then we can tell you how to fix the holes we found before the bad guys break in.
Yeah. You know, it's I started university in 91. And they had us on Unix terminals, and we had a class where they would, one of the first classes you had to take was, you know, understanding Unix so you could use it. And I remember this command they had, which was finger, where you could identify one of your buddies on campus, figure out, you know, which computer lab they were in.
Yeah.
And I thought this was cool. And it's like, you know, my brother-in-law, I was in Raleigh, I was at NC State. And my brother-in-law was working in Houston for a company called Wiltel. I said, well, let me see if I can do it with his email. And I was able to do that. And I was able to find out how long he was at his desk and, you know, and all that. And a few weeks later, I tried it again and, you know, nothing came back. And I asked him, I said, hey, what happened? And he said, yeah, it turns out you set off our cyber alarms and they had to kind of shut that down. But you know, in the early days of the internet, things were just kind of wide open. I could peek into somebody else's network.
Yeah, it's. I mean, the internet was created by like a bunch of hippies, really, that just wanted to share data, you know. And now we live in a vastly different world where people want to steal your data and make money off of it. It's done like a big shift. And unfortunately, we're still using a lot of the technologies that were created back then, which were not designed with security. So we're trying to bolt on security at different levels, which is, you know, part of the challenge.
Yeah. Well, cool. So what's Blue Goat Cyber? What does that do?
Blue Goat Cyber is my new cybersecurity company. We primarily focus on medical device security. So we test medical devices from a medical device manufacturer to make sure they are secure and a cyber criminal can't break into them. And we help the device manufacturer get those devices approved by the FDA in the United States and the EU MDR in Europe. And the whole idea is a lot of us probably don't realize, you might if you've been in the hospital, which you have, that on average, there's like 14 medical devices connected to a hospital bed or in the proximity of a hospital bed. And a lot of those devices have had vulnerabilities, like a drug infusion pump. And if somebody can hack into that pump, as example, and increase the flow rate of a drug like morphine, they could kill somebody. So I've shifted our focus, my focus on medical devices, because I feel the risk is a lot more severe than, you know, somebody stealing your credit card information off of a website. So that's the focus of my new cybersecurity company.
Wow, that's cool. Yeah, as you were talking about, I was sitting there trying to think what would be the benefit. And yeah, I guess if there's somebody you don't like, it's a good way of doing that.
Well, it doesn't have to be someone you don't like. A lot of malicious software just propagates autonomously, and when it lands on a target, if the cyber criminal can use that to make money or do something, then they will. So if you have a vulnerable system, it might, you know, the malicious software that's propagating might land on that. And, you know, we do work with implantables too, like pacemakers for a while had a massive vulnerability because these things have to have wireless capability. And I wrote about this in my first book. Like Dick Cheney was so afraid that someone was going to kill him by wirelessly hacking into his pacemaker that he had it removed for a while. So, you know, we're living in a little bit different world, and this is the world I live in. Some of us don't see these things very often, but they're like, I see them all the time. So it's a lot of risk, and it's the advancements in healthcare. I don't want to be seen rolled backwards because we have medical devices with lots of vulnerabilities.
It's a noble mission. Well, and this kind of leads to my question about your first book about the smartest person in the room. So you're obviously very accomplished, very smart, but you're saying that there's some type of fallacy by seeking to be the smartest person in the room. What do you mean by that?
In cybersecurity and other high-tech industries, people get their significance typically by being, quote, you know, smarter than somebody else. And we all want to feel significant. It's just how it happens in cybersecurity and other industries. And if you're always trying to be intellectually or rationally smarter than other people, it inhibits collaboration and it inhibits communication because you're always looking for a way to prove that you're brighter. And I wrote about this because I realized after a lot of struggles with my first company, 99% of my problems were because my staff lacked emotional intelligence. It wasn't because they weren't rationally intelligent. They all had super high IQs. They just didn't have the EQ to go with it. So they would talk over clients' heads. They would, you know, wait for a teammate to say something and then ridicule them for not already knowing something. It was just like this weird dynamic that I watched play out. And then I realized that this has been going on for my entire career. If I look back over 20 plus years in cybersecurity, this pattern has repeated itself, which that was the impetus for the book. I fixed that problem in my company. So I added the emotional intelligence and the people skills to my already highly rational and rationally intelligent staff. And then my problems went away. My clients started loving us. They came back for annual contracts. My team worked together better, and it really improved everybody's life.
Really cool. I mean, now that you laid that out as if that was really simple, that seems like a big change to make in a culture.
It wasn't simple.
How'd you do it?
So it was, it's an easy concept, right? But it's not a simple concept, but not easy to implement. I did a couple things. I did weekly training with my team. We did some neuro-linguistic programming training, some communication skills training, people skills training, a number of different topics. And I realized not everybody was on board. There were some of my staff that simply were grounded in their own ego and their own identity, and they didn't want to shift their identity. They had what I would refer to as a fixed mindset instead of a growth mindset. So I had to let some people go. They just simply weren't willing to adapt. And then any new people I hired them based on my core values first to make sure they align with what I wanted in the organization. And only if they passed those core values in the culture that I look at their technical skills. So I flipped the script on how I hired people, because in the past, I hired people based on their cybersecurity certification, how smart they were, and ignored the other things. And now I didn't even look at that. I don't now either. I don't look at the technical stuff until after they pass all the other items first, because I think the technical skills are what I like to refer to as skills with a finite shelf life, whereas the emotional intelligence and people skills and life skills have an infinite shelf life. So it behooves you to learn those other skills over technical skills.
You know, this is going to be one of those clippable moments from this interview, because what you just said is so incredibly profound. The technical skills have a finite shelf life, but the EQ skills persist on.
That's right.
That is so powerful, so important. Now, when you let some of the people go, were some of the people that you let go technically strong, technically valuable to the company?
100%.
That had to be scary.
It was scary. You know, when you're a business owner and you've got someone that you rely on technically, even if they're rough around the edges and they piss people off periodically, you think, how am I going to do it without this person? Because they're super, you know, brilliant, a brilliant mind. But when I let them go, I felt this like major sense of like, you know, release. Like I could exhale. Like I was holding my breath the whole time and I could exhale. And other people picked up the slack. It wasn't that big of a deal. It wasn't as big of a deal as I made it out to be in my head.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's a good word for other business owners listening, other leaders listening, because it would seem easy to keep delaying that decision to let that person go because of the fear that, you know, that nobody will be able to fill that void and step in their shoes.
Yeah, you also, at least for me, I had to look at it from the perspective of my team as well. If I'm trying to set this new culture, my team is looking at me to enforce that culture. Culture just doesn't happen. You have to enforce it. And if I'm allowing somebody to be toxic in the environment and not doing something about it, what does that say about my own leadership abilities? And they're going to get frustrated. So they'd be like, well, Christian said, this is how we're going to run a company. This is how we're going to be. But he's allowing this, you know, individual to not fall in line with our values anymore. So it really is, from a leadership perspective, it's also something I felt strongly that I had to take action, because it wasn't just about me. It was also about my team.
Yeah. Well, Christian, this has gone a lot longer than our normal interviews go, but it's because you've been bringing so much value. And there's three lessons that I heard in this. One is, from a healthcare perspective, take ownership of your own healthcare. Nobody's going to care about it more than you. I think I heard you say that.
Mm-hmm.
And the second is, make the most of micro moments focused on the people that you're with, and seize the opportunity in those moments. And that kind of ties into the third thing, which is, emotional intelligence will outlive and be ultimately more valuable than technical skills, which are transient.
100%.
Christian, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say, and we have to realize AI is going to replace most of those technical jobs in the near future. So if you only have technical skills, you're more replaceable by AI.
Yeah. So anytime I post something on AI, I get people coming at me, even when I'm trying to say AI is a game changer. And the thing that I'm cautioning against is, AI is not your new blog writer and it's not your new customer support team. There's something that the humans still need to do. And it's funny. I have one guy, I think this was to some comment or post I made about, don't hand customer support over to AI. And this guy wrote me this really nasty message, or at least that's the way it felt to me. It left me not feeling happy, not feeling warm about this guy. And then the very last line in the message was, by the way, this was written by AI. I'm like, dude, you just made my point.
Yeah.
You know, it's that back to that emotional intelligence. So yeah, it's interesting. There's a lot of spirited debates about AI. But it is a game changer. I just think we have to be careful about how we use it.
100%. Yep.
Well, Christian, this has been great. How do people reach you?
Yeah, a couple ways. They can go to my company website, bluegoatcyber.com, or my personal website, christianespinoza.com. And my books are all available on Amazon. The audiobook for The In-Between Life and the Micro just came out about 3 weeks ago. So that's available as well.
Well, excellent. Well, Christian, thank you for being on Leaders and Legacies.
Yeah, thank you so much, Craig, for having me on.
This is Craig Andrews. I want to thank you for listening to the Leaders and Legacies podcast. We're looking for leaders to share how they're making impact beyond themselves. If that's you, please go to alliesforme.com/guest and sign up there. If you got something out of this interview, we would love you to share this episode on social media. Just do a quick screenshot with your phone and text it to a friend or post it on the socials. If you know someone who would be a great guest, tag them on social media and let them know about the show, including the hashtag Leaders and Legacies. I love seeing your posts and suggestions. We are regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you don't miss anything, please go ahead and subscribe. Your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show. And it means a lot to me. It means a lot to my team. If you want to know more, please go to alliesforme.com or follow me on LinkedIn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.